Hello, everyone. Welcome to a very special episode of Uncanny Treks. We are winding down our coverage of Star Trek Strange New World Season 3. We've got to talk about the finale. Then we've got to do an episode about Season 2, which we never did. Then we will do an episode about Season 3. I am Bob in Cascadia. That is Matt in the Southland. Matt, how you doing at the end of Season 3?
Oh, man, Bob. I don't know. It's sad that the season's over. I want more Strange New Worlds. I always want more SNW. Come on.
Well, I'm torn and I'm sad for two reasons. Sad that we are not going to have any Strange New Worlds for a year, except for, you know, books and comics. Although we might go back at some point and revisit that Marvel comic from the 90s, Star Trek Early Voyages. That would be interesting to compare to this, since it's doing basically the same thing in a very different way. But yeah. I'm also sad because this season finale kind of sucks, Matt.
Yeah, I'm not going to say it's the best end to this season. It's not the worst they could have done. And I'm not going to say it's bad TV either, Bob. Like, I'm not going to say it's like a complete, it's not going to the dumpster fire. I'll give you that.
I'm texting my friends, like trying to get them to lower their expectations for this. And I've been saying, look, there's a lot to like in the finale, but it's got some terrible stuff. There's one particular subplot that I would unquestionably put in the dumpster fire. And then everything else, it's not bad. So it has me even it out to say it's...
Yeah, surprisingly, Bob, I think you did that for me, because when I was watching it at first, I kept that in mind because you had texted me prior to me watching it. I was like, man, I'm a little worried about this. And then, yeah, you're right. There's hit and miss pieces to it. It's had to write themselves out of something.
I had asked you in the notes if you thought the name of this episode, New Lives and New Civilizations, sounded like a series finale title.
It really does.
And... you said there was speculation online that this was written to be a series finale. I usually don't seek this stuff out, but an interview with a couple of the writers and producers came across my desk, and I read that, and they did, in fact, write this as a series finale. I thought they did know that season 4 was already a done deal, but maybe it was an issue of we knew by the time season 3 was airing, but they didn't know in production that season 4 was happening.
The production for this took place during 2023 or something. I'm thinking, yeah, we didn't learn and there was going to be another season and a half till less than a year ago.
We learned about there would be a half season 5 pretty recently.
Right.
But I feel we've known for a long time.
It does feel there is a bookend, definitely, Bob, with the ending. We'll get to that when we talk about the ending in this episode. But man, there were so many different ways it felt like they were setting up for other things I don't think are going to happen.
Another thing to say is, I think they might have been a little bit burned by how they did the production for season 2, and they left on a cliffhanger. And then it seemed, maybe this is not right, but my impression at the time was the fans were pretty angry because there was the cliffhanger on season 2, and then there was the big delay because of the writer's strike. And that's just business. It happens, but fans are not always so understanding. I also wonder if they didn't know they were going to get season 4, but they also just felt a little burned by that experience of it cliffhangers. Oh, not going to do that again.
Yeah, and we'll be talking about that cliffhanger in our season review coverage of season 3.
So what actually goes down in New Life and New Civilizations, Matt?
Well, Bob, the crew discover that the Vesda lifeform who inhabited Ensign Gamble has rebuilt his body, and it was transported to a planet where the Vesda are worshipped as gods.
So we start out in terms of just the episode itself with a going away party for Battelle as she goes to take over Starfleet legal or whatever. And did this going away party for Battelle immediately think she was a goner?
Oh, yeah. Something's going to happen. They got it all set up. They got everybody together. I just know because it's not a Batman thing that the actual violence will happen at the party.
That's funny. And it is interesting that it does seem every Strange New Worlds finale is about Battelle nearly dying. I guess season 1 was not, but season 2 was definitely very much Battelle in danger as well.
Just to remind fans, the Quality of Mercy was the season finale from the first season, and it was a retelling of Balance of Terror. She was in that, but there was nothing about her going to die. That's when you learn that her and Pike are a couple.
So we get to this world, Skygowan, where, like you say, the Vesda are worshipped as gods.
Don't get me wrong, I feel like that whole planet was cool to look at, but didn't really serve much of a purpose. If you think about it, the grand scheme of things, they just get transported to another planet where the actual stuff goes down.
On the one hand, I'm almost sad they didn't save it for a different episode, right? Where they explored that planet for some sort of sci-fi allegory. But on the other hand, you got to give them credit. The design of that planet with all the upside down pyramids.
That was cool.
It's very much oriented to the Vesda themselves. So it makes sense that you would want it for the Vesda, right? So I don't know if it would have been as effective on a world where the Vesda weren't involved.
Well, I agree. Yeah, for sure. It's just interesting that we go to this world and then we have them zap to another world via the door or whatever, yeah. The plot device that just wasn't my favorite either. We'll get to that.
We already mentioned that Nurse Gamble, possessed by the Vesda, returns, but there was a really good reveal of him in the temple, and the way he's dressed, it's very Stargate. Now, I've never seen Stargate the show. I've just seen Stargate the movie, but it's very Stargate.
What's that mask thing he's got on that's like weird? He's literally standing in front of a damn Stargate, Bob. It's hard not to.
In an ancient temple.
Now. In an ancient temple. Some of the visual effects, but Stargate.
How do you feel about La'an breaking out of Vulcan nerve pinch?
She teaches Spock how to dance, Bob, and he teaches her Vulcan martial arts, so it's a fair trade.
I'm a little crankier about that. This is going to contradict something I'm going to say later where we get into my huge problem with this episode. But I like the idea that only Vulcans can do the Vulcan nerve pinch.
Well, it makes sense in that it's supposed to be telepathic in some way. Not just something anybody can do.
I always thought it just required some fine motor control that maybe humans can't.
Possibly, Bob. I don't know. But is there anything? Can you actually knock somebody out by holding down on an artery like that? If you stop the blood flow. But I don't think it's going to be as like cool as just falling over.
I don't think it's going to be.
You'd probably put him in the hospital.
Pacifistic pinch is interesting as they came up with it on the original series because Spock is supposed to be a very non-violent character, right?
Right.
And so. You want a very non-violent way for him to render someone unconscious. Well, Matt, when Sam Kirk showed up in this episode, you know, kind of with the feeling of doom we had for Batel, I had the feeling that, man, it's really good for Sam Kirk that we know he dies in a TOS episode because otherwise he would have death written all over.
Oh, a lot of these characters did, Bob. And I have to keep reminding myself, too, that Mbinga shows up later, too. Like, it almost cheapens it to some degree. But yeah. Do you always have to remind yourself when you see Sam Kirk, Bob, do you have to remind yourself that he was a xenoanthropologist?
Well, no, Matt, I actually don't have to remind myself because I never remember. I'm always thinking whenever Sam Kirk is doing anything work-related, which thankfully, I sound sarcastic, but Sam Kirk is just slightly annoying and Kirk's brother. He's not
right.
Doing a lot of work stuff in the show. But when he does show up for work stuff, I'm always, what is his job again? Then when he's making these, and this begins to get into my problem with this episode, when he starts making these weird pronouncements about the nature of evil. I'm like, what does this guy do? And then I saw in something before you said it here, he's a xenoanthropologist. And I'm like, oh, okay. I guess on the one hand, that makes sense. On the other hand, I don't think anybody on the Strange New Worlds writing staff has ever taken an anthropology class.
No, I doubt it. For some reason, my brain too, when I read xenoanthropologist, I think of a cryptid guy. That's not right, because there's actually alien species in the show, so it makes sense for him to study their anatomy. But if he was on Earth and we didn't know the aliens, he would have a really dumb job.
Well, and we would disambiguate between there could be xenoanthropology versus cryptoanthropology. How do you feel about Pelia calling Spock Spocko?
I was okay with her calling him Spocko because she's such a creature of the 60s. And that whole sock it to me, sock it.
She's a manic pixie 60s old lady, so I'm down for that too. I thought it was cute. I did think it was interesting. It didn't pay off, but we did have a lot of small references to the other hostile aliens in the original series Era Trek this episode. They talked about the planet that worships the Vesda, the Skygowan. It trades with the Orion. And then in that meeting scene where Pelia calls Spock Spocko and Sam Kirk says some absurd things about evil, there's a map that's centralizing Federation and Tholian space.
When they whipped out the good versus evil stuff, Bob, in this show, I shut down. That was too cheese for me. Once I started seeing the display of the wall paintings or whatever, or the designs of the dark and the light, I was like, come on. What is this?
How do you feel about them coming up with an interstellar version of ley lines?
That comes back to the discussion we had about Sam being there. If anybody's going to introduce this, it may as well be him. Although weird that Spock agreed with it. And as a human being, Bob, on Earth, a real person, do you believe in ley lines?
I do not believe in ley lines, although I must say I'm aware of them as a belief, And I'm mostly aware of them as from Batman, that Ra's al Ghul has his Lazarus pits along ley lines.
It's the only way you can, like, that's the only cool thing I've ever heard about ley lines, and I know it's not real.
I don't believe in them, but I also have not investigated the matter, so I'm not speaking from a position of informed skepticism there. I'm speaking of a position of generally disbelieving New Age stuff. I saw some people online who were really bothered by the ley line crap being in Star Trek. I'm not bothered by it. Maybe it's not my preference, but it's other stuff in this episode I feel strongly about. Lines.
Yeah, as long as they don't come back to it, we're good.
I wouldn't even take it far.
I don't want, that's too magic for me, Bob. I don't want, yes.
It is potentially too powerful, and it's also too redundant of what Discovery was doing with the mycelial network, potentially. So I see what you're saying in that.
Exactly, yeah. You can't have ley lines where they could potentially get back to Earth so easily and then them not actually explore that. If Sam was back here coming up with these ideas back in the days of Spock and Pike.
No, it's a very fair point. So one thing to keep on the positive before we get to the really negative, they have the ritual on Skygallen where the Vesda have the Skygallenites do this like collective eye trauma ritual in synchronization. And that was really gory and really cool, I thought.
Here's the thing about this is what I love. I go online. Okay, let's see what people are bitching about here. They were upset that when the landing party comes down and all these folks are around with no eyeballs and they go and they take out the Vesda with the nerve pinch, no one reacts. They don't have eyes. They literally show them stabbing out their own eyes. And we're talking comments all the way down, Bob. No one's saying this. Just everybody, stupid.
There's so much bad in this episode.
On top of that, I will say there's one, we'll get to the next part where they do mention this to some degree, but this was the big part when Leanne does take them out that from the nerve pinch, and it's in broad daylight. I mean, come on. They don't have eyeball.
Yeah, please.
They made that clear.
To stick with a few more positive things, I did really like that Pike now calls Kirk James, and Kirk saying no offense to Spock on that initial subspace call. That was pretty sweet. And then I don't know if we knew Mbinga's first language was Swahili. If we didn't, I thought that was a very cool fact.
Mbinga has slowly become my favorite character in Star Trek. Everything about him is so interesting to me, too. He's my favorite character at this point.
On the one hand, I agree with you that I really like Mbinga. I'm really glad he's on the show. He's one of my favorite characters. I'm a little less positive than you because I just don't find the fact that he was a special forces operator compelling. It's cheesy. I also don't love that now every time there's a Mbinga spotlight episode, it's about how he used to be a badass.
That's what makes him cool.
I liked it when the Mbinga spotlight episode was, oh, he has his daughter hidden in the transporter.
Yeah, that was a cool episode too.
He is a cool character. He's maybe a little overstuffed. I don't think he needs to be a special forces badass.
Mom wants him to be a boring doctor.
I want him to be a sad former dad, also a happy-go-lucky fisherman, and a good doctor. Yeah. One of the things season 3 was missing me was the feeling of Mbinga and Chapel being mad scientists together. Speaking of action and huge badassery, Matt, did you get a Mortal Kombat vibe from that move Campbell did on the away team before the portal?
There's some really good action scenes in this, so the people complaining about the lack of action, this was cool. I was more impressed by Mbinga nonchalantly threatening suicide with a knife than launching Gamble back through the doorway. That was the coolest thing.
Matt likes his doctor. He's a super badass.
Then I know he's not going to die. He falls over. But he ain't dead. I saw him in TOS.
Is it time to talk about what really sucks about this episode?
Let's move on to it. Let's talk about what sucks.
Okay. So one thing I want to begin with is there have been a lot of people complaining on Serialized about this show doing genetic determinism. I thought they were right, but I thought they were being a bit overwrought in their criticism. Does that distinction make sense?
Yeah.
However, when we get to this episode, I do have to say that all the people criticizing this season of the show for genetic determinism, they were right and I was wrong. This show goes way, it's insane.
It's wild, yes. This is crazy. When we got to this part, I was, am I watching Star Trek? What is this weirdness?
As best I can reconstruct it, because Batel is human, but has gotten an Illyrian blood transfusion and has the remnants of the Gorn from when it implanted inside her, and because she has a mind meld with Spock, She is now a hybrid, and she has all four species, quote, racial memories, unquote, or as they use the term in this, their epigenetic experience of fighting the evil of the Vesta in prehistory. And so now she becomes the race memory superhero? What the hell? That's one of those things, it's trying to be woke, but it's one of those things where you're woke, but you don't know how to do it, so you become racist. It's crazy.
Not strange in a good way.
The thing that really killed me was, I think you in the notes compare it to Star Wars, and I see what you're saying.
Yeah, it's like the Clorians, they're destined. Yeah,
they do try to wind it
in. Where I get the Star Wars feel.
Yeah, so it's destiny and a racial memory. So yeah, that's real fascism, folks. When you're doing destiny and eugenics, that's some super fascism. But it's also just really lame MCU superhero thing. It turns Battelle into, I don't know, Captain America. It's so shit.
Well, the perfect comparison that I have seen people make is Captain Marvel.
Oh yeah, because the Kree human. I didn't even think about that, but you're exactly right.
Even her power set.
I actually like the Captain Marvel movie and the Marvel movies. I don't think they're great, but I enjoyed them. I think they're fun superhero movies.
Right.
But man, this has to make me retroactively dislike them a little, because in the immortal words of Anton Chigurh, if the road you were on led you to this point, of what use was the road?
Had they not rushed this whole thing into one episode and tried to... I know we had all the things happen to Battelle prior to this, but there were no real hints of this is what's going to happen at the end.
To interrupt there, it's interesting that on the one hand, this really does synthesize the whole season together and give the whole season a full identity in an interesting way. But like you're saying, it's also only in this finale, because even though they're picking up the plot elements from four or so previous episodes this season, there's no sense that this is what they're building to in those prior episodes.
And it makes you question if this was the idea in the end. Well, we've had this all happen to Battelle.
I'm going to slightly push back on what you're saying otherwise. To me, the problem is not that this is rushed. In fact, this is such a stupid idea.
He doesn't want it to be slow burn.
If you're going to do it, rush it, by all means. But yeah, to me, the problem is just the idea. And in a way, it's not even the idea. It's the way they talk about it. It's the rhetoric about epigenetic memory and evil. It frankly is kind of fascist. You were saying the combination of genetic determinism and a sense of destiny. That's crazy, man.
That's weird.
I would say, though, the weird thing is if you had just taken out the rhetoric about epigenesis and evil, and you had just been, oh no, because of the genetic hybridity that Battelle now has, she's the only one that can stop them. If you'd just done it like that, if you hadn't called her the Protector, capital P.
It wasn't the Beholder?
I thought they called her the Protector, but maybe I'm wrong. They did talk about Beholders to the point where I was confused, and I was like, is the Beholder a god species from the original series?
Yeah, that's exactly what I did. I thought this was just another retread, and that was another theme of this season of like going back to TOS and like all these godlike creatures and things that we were gonna, but no, that's not the case. I thought the Beholder was somebody important.
I think there was a TNG episode called Eyes of the Beholder, just a metaphorical title.
Right.
To me, that's what's so frustrating about this, is if they had just made this not so weird and fascist, if they had kept basically the same plot, it would have been fine. It wouldn't have been as good as the prior two finales, but it would have been perfectly serviceable and would not be complaining about it for 10 minutes on our podcast.
Yeah, Battelle will be back, I'm sure, at some point.
I don't think so, man.
I think she's going to magically show up and help, like they Wesley Crusher in The Traveler.
So you don't think she's going to come back in the season and a half they have left of this episode, of this show, right?
No, she won't be back for Strange New Worlds, no. But I'm just thinking, if we go into another Enterprise or something, if we move into the...
If they do Star Trek Year One, it is uncomfortably possible that she could show up in that. But no, people are not going to remember this fondly. As much as we don't understand it, people remember Wesley fondly. Yeah, there's a reason he pops up in Picard and Prodigy. I don't like it, but people remember him fondly. People are going to remember this show fondly, but nobody's going to remember the time Battelle became a destiny-endowed racial superhero. Let's move from one controversial thing to another controversial thing. We get a new origin for the Kirk-Spock friendship from their mind meld to synchronize the phasers here. And I thought it was pretty funny. I've seen some fans online who are really angry about this as a retcon, and I get it. I see why they're irritated. There's something that a little bit cheapens the original series about, oh, Kirk and Spock are already just mind-meld bros instead of them slowly developing a deep friendship over the course of the show. But even though I get why it makes people angry, I don't mind it. Where did you come down on the romantic mind-meld that Kirk and Spock have?
My headcanon likes to believe that this mind meld created this permanent connection between Spock and Kirk for like the rest of their lifetime. I like the scene how it just cuts immediately to them doing the action with the ship. And they're just word for word, same thing. Everything's in sync.
One of the things Battelle does with her new racial memory, anti-evil powers, is that she creates a little pocket universe for her and Pike for them to chill in. And when I saw this, I thought the Nexus from Star Trek Generations. But apparently you and the writers were thinking the Inner Light from Star Trek The Next Generation.
Yeah, it's a miniature Inner Light, Bob. He's having the whole lifetime he could have had with Battelle. Just the same way that Picard could have had a life with a family instead of captaining a ship, and he could learn how to play a flute and all that good stuff.
What did you feel about this development? Do you like it? Do you not like it?
I liked it. I just feel like they could have framed it in a way where they should have started the episode off with this sort of them already in this Nexus and then work back to where eventually you find out they're in this battle on this planet.
That's the idea.
Because in my brain, then I'll be like, oh, wait, has Pike made it out? Is Pike not met his destiny?
Or maybe you intercut it, yeah, some way.
Yeah.
I thought this was pretty well done. It's a little bit tarnished because of how Battelle sets it up, just because it's so dumb that she's the superhero. But yeah, the actual scenes of them getting older was cool. Him getting the Chef Pike apron was cute. The puppy was cute. Juliet Pike and Elijah April getting engaged was cute. Did you ever have a moment while watching this? I was pretty sure that I understood exactly what Battelle was doing from jump, but there was a moment when I was wondering, oh, are they trying to write themselves out of being a prequel and to Star Trek and trying to create the parallel timeline? And it's going to be, oh, Battelle uses her new racial god powers to give Pike the gift of not winding up in the chair.
I did really think that at one point because I was saying at the top of the episode, there's so many paths they look like they were trying to create for potential spinoffs, whatever they need to do to make the next incarnation of Trek come out, which you can see. I really do think there was some pressure at this point to make sure they could get that next season in and the additional half a season for fifth.
I did think the way this Nexus or Inner Light scenario sort of did with Nurse Gamble at the door, that was a pretty cool image. I liked it.
It was neat with the whole knocking the whole time.
My last big thought on the episode was I really enjoyed La'an's annoyance that Kirk has mind-melded with Spock. And so La'an and Kirk never hooked up, but now Kirk has mind-melded with Spock, who has hooked up with La'an. Pretty annoyed about that. I thought that was cute. It was very sentimental, especially to whatever the mediocre grunge song was. But the images of the Kirk boys sharing a drink and Pike and Number One sharing a sad drink, and also the image of Mabinga and Chapel hugging, the montage of the episode, I thought all that was sweet.
It was all great. I didn't have any issues with that at all. And as a season finale, this was not spectacular. He means,
yeah.
As a series finale, this would have sucked.
Well, in a way,
you would have had an ending.
Yeah. Well, Matt, who was your character of the finale?
I'm giving it to Dr. Mabinga.
Scotty's barely in it, but I'm going to give it to Scotty, both because he is wearing his formal kilt to the Battelle's going away party at the beginning, which is cute. And I also really enjoy his impression of Pelia as Dracula.
I really like, too, that this was the Scotty thing was a callback to Uhura. Remember at the beginning when she showed up in her formal wear? The callbacks they do, especially to
the new officers. Okay, Matt, you had the reaction of the week. Do you want to hit us with the reaction of the week,
Bob? So there was a Yahoo review headline on my feed: "Strange New Worlds turns Star Trek into Doctor Who and destroys the entire franchise for its season 3 finale."
That's a little hyperbole.
Well, All I did, Bob, was maybe want to talk a little bit about Doctor Who for a moment, because there is a Doctor Who reference in this episode.
Which I actually totally missed until I saw people talking about it online, which is funny because there's also a Doctor Who reference. We mentioned this on an earlier episode in the Scavenger episode, where you see amidst the wreckage that the Scavengers have, you see the TARDIS, right? We missed it during the episode. It's very hard to see. It's pretty small, but we did talk about it, I think, the next week after the internet had pointed it out.
But Doctor Who just keeps showing up in Trek, especially this season. I'm just curious, Bob, if Pelia was to be the Doctor's companion, which Doctor do you think she was the companion of?
This is a hard question, Matt. So I wanted to briefly spell out the nicknames of the 15 Doctors, because that gives you some sense of their personality. And that would make my answer a little bit more meaningful.
Before you do that, Bob, let me just say this. I do not have any real knowledge of these Doctors other than there was a Lego game that came out. It's called Lego Dimensions. And I learned who some of the characters were. I learned the general idea of what Doctor Who does, but that was about it. I have no clue who these people really are. So if I do make fun of them and you're a huge Doctor Who fan, don't take offense.
And whereas Matt has very little knowledge of Doctor Who, I would say I have maybe about knowledge of Doctor Who. I've watched pretty much all the most famous classic Doctor Who, but I've seen very little of the new Doctor Who. All right, Matt, how about we do this? How about, I should have put this in order for you. I'm sorry. This will be a little challenging, but why don't you find on my list number one, identify number one, make any comments about their appearance?
This is challenging. I have to match a number with this graphic. This is ridiculous, Bob. How hard is this? Okay, number one, you've got Grandfather, who just looks like some old man who probably, like, he looks like the kind of guy you would see hung up on the wall of a government building.
So that's the first Doctor Who.
Grandfather, yes.
People call him the first Doctor, the second Doctor. I find that a really annoying thing. I say, yeah, the show is called Doctor Who, I say Doctor. And yeah, I know Doctor Who fans hate that. And you know what? That's fine. All right, Matt, he's number two.
All right, number two, you've got Cosmic Hobo.
Patrick Troughton is the actor. I love the Cosmic Hobo.
Number three is Dandy. The Dandy looks like, if you're a fan of Bravo, it looks like Lisa Vanderpump's husband.
The Dandy is one of the worst, I would say the worst Doctor Who that I've ever encountered. The real bad thing about the Dandy, especially the first half of his run, is it's during the spy craze in the late 60s. And so they confine him to Earth, and he's working for a military unit on Earth, and he's using his Venusian kung fu. It's so bad, man. It's so bad.
His hair is in such a coif. It's just amazing. All right, number four, Bob, you have the Bohemian.
All right, so this is, the actor is Tom Baker. He's the most famous Doctor Who of the classic set. I think the show is already playing on PBS in America, but he's the one who, when Doctor Who started to, you know, to the extent it got big in America in the 70s, it was Tom Baker doing it. This is not a selling point for me, even though I do really like the Tom Baker era, but Douglas Adams, the guy who wrote Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, he was writing some episodes for the Tom Baker Doctor Who. And so another thing to point out, we're having a lot of Star Trek Doctor Who crossover right now, at least teasing of it. They did do a comic a while that's a Star Trek Doctor Who crossover. And the main frame of the crossover is it's the Next Generation and a later Doctor, which we'll talk about when we get to that later Doctor. Inside the crossover, there's a flashback where Kirk and Spock and the TOS Enterprise meet the Tom Baker Doctor Who. They meet the Bohemian.
If you're a layman Doctor Who fan, this is the one that wears the scarf. You have the fifth Doctor, who is the cricketer, who looks like a douche.
Do you see what's on his lapel?
Is that sage?
A stalk of celery.
Oh, a stalk of celery.
He's not one of my favorites. He's
okay.
How about number six?
Number six looks a lot like they tried to go back to the other guy, but just change his outfit a little bit. The madman.
The actor is actually named Colin Baker, too. No relation to Tom Baker. The Madman's interesting because he's the first Doctor who they portray as a bit evil, a bit sadistic. They go some interestingly dark places with the Madman.
After the Madman, Bob, you've got Umbrella, who I've seen him before, and he looks the most interesting to me because of his outfit. He always seemed off, mismatched. And anytime I looked at like the Lego characters, he was the one that stuck out. He looks more like a hobo than Cosmic Hobo.
Matt just really likes a Riddler umbrella.
That's what it boils down to.
I'm not a big fan of the umbrella. He's the last of the classic Doctors. They canceled the show while he's the Doctor. And it's not really his fault. It's more the writing. But I don't love his portrayal of the Doctor.
Give me like an idea of what year that was, around the late 80s.
I think it was canceled in 89. First season in 1963. I believe the first episode airs maybe the same day as the Kennedy assassination.
Oh,
27 years maybe.
Keaton Batman had to take him out.
Keaton Batman took him out. And then in the 90s, they tried to do an American Doctor Who in a TV movie on UPN. It was originally supposed to be a pilot, but it was a failed pilot, but they showed it as a TV movie. That gives you the eighth Doctor, the Byronic Doctor.
He looks boring.
A lot of purists hate that TV movie. Mm. I thought it was pretty fun. I like the Byronic Doctor pretty well.
Then you've got the next Doctor, number nine, is the Survivor.
Eccleston, he comes back in 2006 or something, yeah. About 5 years in between the classic Doctors and the TV movie Doctor, and then about 10 years in between the TV movie Doctor and the revival of Doctor Who. Christopher Eccleston only sticks around for one season. He's a great actor, though, and he's interesting as a Doctor. Maybe not amazing, interesting.
And then next up, you've got the Lonely God, number 10, who I think was just doing a Loki impression the whole time.
In fairness, it's more Loki's doing an impression of him.
Oh, shoot.
I haven't seen Loki, the TV show, but apparently Loki, the TV show, is heavy Doctor Who influence. But imagine this Doctor and the next Doctor are the two that are most influencing what Tom Hiddleston is doing there.
Right. And then you've got, because the next Doctor is Raggedy Man.
Yeah, that's Matt Smith, the great character actor who, he and David Tennant, who plays the Lonely God, both still very much around pop culture, yep. Right?
And then you got number 12, the Magician.
Yeah, that's Peter Capaldi. He's a much older Doctor. Peter Capaldi got famous for being a very foul-mouthed fixer on a show written by the guy who wrote Veep, a comedy about British politics. Peter Capaldi, who became the Magician, was the foul-mouthed Scottish political fixer in that show. He's a great show. I hear good things about his time as the Doctor, but I haven't gotten past The Lonely God. I've watched, I think, two of The Lonely Gods, three or four seasons. So that's where I've fallen off. Now we're just talking about what I generically know from pop culture.
And then, Bob, we get to Doctor 13, and finally we have a female Doctor, the Timeless Child.
Pretty unfortunate that that is her epitaph, the Timeless Child. You would not maybe pick that for the lady. There is a 14th Doctor, but it's too stupid and too boring to explain. And then there's a 15th Doctor, who is the Dancing Man, which is also maybe an unfortunate epitaph for the first Black Doctor, but there you have it.
Well, there you have your Doctors, Bob. So if we had to pick one that Carol Kane's Pelia is going to hang out with, I would probably go with number 4. Bohemian. I'd go with Bohemian.
You would Tom Baker. It's more the mid-70s. Yeah.
So I could see that being a pretty interesting time for Pelia. I don't see her hanging out with Grandfather or maybe Cosmic Hobo. Maybe.
Definitely not Grandfather. Definitely her hanging out with number 3, with John Pertree, with the Dandy. That would not be good either. I was thinking about her with the Bohemian, with Tom Baker, with number 4. The problem with that to me is that Tom Baker has the best companions. He has Sarah Jane is one of them, and he's got a couple other just absolutely wonderful companions. And so, in a way, I don't want to put that pressure on Pelia. Oh. You see what I'm saying?
You had crappy companions, Bob.
Well, I would say that I think Pelia could have good chemistry with number 6, the Madman.
Okay.
But I also think that could go in a pretty weird direction, because one of the problems is the Madman had companions that wouldn't really check him very well.
Oh.
And so if you had Pelia checking the Madman constantly, that might get a little weird. I would really enjoy her hanging out with number 2, Patrick Troughton, the Cosmic, because he's basically my favorite.
They'd have fun, too, just based on this illustration of him. We just eliminated the newer Doctors. We're just like, forget it. That's just not going to be fun.
Well, another problem, and I'm not sure how much this is a problem after David Tennant, but with David Tennant, my man really has too much sexual chemistry with his companions. The Doctor should not have sexual chemistry with his companions. That's weird. So that's one of the reasons I'm shying away from the new one. Although I guess if Pelia wanted to have sexual chemistry with the Timeless Child with Jodie Whittaker, Dr. 13. That would be cute. Another person I think would be a good match would be the Cricketeer. I think Palea and the Cricketeer are on the same frequency.
Keep in mind, folks, I'm just judging based on one picture where the man has a stalk of celery attached to his lapel, so I don't know anything about this guy.
This was fun, Matt. This is somewhat reviving my interest in Doctor Who, because Noah just told me what happens at the end of what's the final season of Doctor Who for now, that the end of the Dancing Man's time as the Doctor, and oh my god, it's terrible.
Oh.
So I was thinking about just not watching any more Doctor Who, because it's, oh god, if this is where it all ends, then why am I working towards this?
It's like everything we watch, Bob. Star Trek's the same way.
Yeah.
Just look at Picard.
Maybe at some point we might do a thing. We wouldn't do this extensively because Doctor Who is not that good, but maybe we could pick one serial for each Doctor.
Oh, yeah, I'd like that. Or just some highlights along the way, just so I could get an idea of what they are. I'm not going to dedicate my life to watching however million episodes are. Especially because some of them are lost, right? There's lost episodes of this show, which is, I think, that's really cool to me. To know there's footage out there of these actual things that no one's seen.
Yeah. Although, it is interesting, for the lost ones, back in the day, I think you'll appreciate this, back in the day, fans in England would do audio recordings of the episodes. And I think most episodes can be reconstructed based on the script, the production stills, and fan audio recordings. You can't watch it, but you can sit there and watch images from it while you hear it.
Did I hear you say the power of AI, Bob?
Oh, right. Have done animated reconstructions of some of the...
Now, that's cool. I like that.
The problem is that the animation is...
That's not cool. Bad. If you're going to go that route, you have to make it look good. Yeah. It reminds me of the Babylon 5 cartoon thing they did.
It's like that. That's the problem. The BBC, it's a state broadcaster. It doesn't have that many resources. It's also worth saying just that the Lost episodes only apply to the first two Doctors. I don't think any third Doctors are lost.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I knew it was the earlier ones, so that's why people aren't freaking out.
Well, it is unfortunate because the second Doctor, the Cosmic Hobo, is my absolute favorite. And he's the one we're missing most of. The grandfather has not actually been that negatively impacted, where it's the Cosmic Hobo who's really, there's a lot of lost.
All right, Bob. Well, this has been good talking about Strange New Worlds, but we have our recap coming up soon.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us on this uncanny trek through the finale to Star Trek Strange New World Season 3, and then also through Doctor Who randomly at the crossover. I'm Bob in Cascadia. That's Matt in the Southland. Have a great night, everyone.
Thanks for listening.